Changing times and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is July the 16th, 2026. This is episode 3870 of the podcast. Cracked another, kind of like even ending number there, 3870. It's a lot of episodes. It's been done over about 18 years for those that might be tuning in for the first time today. And I just want to pause that for a second and tell you guys, we just recently did cross that 18-year anniversary. That was in June. And I want to thank all of you who have helped make this podcast actually last that long, helped us grow, and helped me live the life of my dreams because you guys invest your time and your money and your influence with me. Thank you to everyone who's ever listened over the years or continues to listen and shares the show. And thank you for those who have gotten involved in our various communities and sub-communities in so many great ways. So thank you for that. On just mentioning numbers and dates, though, I do have an important date to release to you guys today. That will be August the 25th, which will be a Monday at 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time. Now, we'll be talking about the daylight time issue next week. I'm not going to get into it today. I've got too much going on with an expert panel show. But that day, I can tell you exactly how far away 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time, August 25th, is. It's 39 days, 21 hours, 55 minutes, and 58, 57, 56 seconds from the time I'm recording this, not from the time you're hearing it. How do I know that? Because I'm sitting on the countdown page right now. You can find that page at jackslaws.com/countdown. And that countdown is to the next launch of our AI for Solopreneurs course. Now, this is a course we have run four times now. We have sold out all four times. The students who have taken the course, there's just no real complaints about it. Everybody's happy. And I have to tell you, the last round was the best round we've had. And I don't know if it's just the people that took it. I don't know if it's the energy level being a little higher. I don't know exactly what it is because the core base material is the same. I do new videos here and there and new bonuses and stuff like that each round. But the output from the students in round four, if you are listening and you were one of those students that completed that course, pat yourself on the back because the work you guys did was exceptional. But we are going to run it again, and we are launching it again on August the 25th. That's a Monday. And that means that if you sign up on that day, you will start getting emails right away that tell you how to get ready for the course, all the things you need to have in place so you're ready on launch day. And then the following Monday, which I guess is September 1st, maybe something like that, September 2nd, I don't know, whatever day it is, it will be when the course actually starts. So you sign up on that Monday and we start on the following Monday. Generally speaking, within an hour or far less of when that sign up opens, it is gone. The reason I tell you all this is if you are already on the list for it, you just didn't get in or you decided not to take it last time or something, then you don't really have to do anything. But if you're not sure or you know you're not on the list, you want to go to jackslaws.com/countdown right now, enter your name and email. And the only thing we use this list for is one purpose. We let you know like a couple weeks before and then like a week before and then like a day before and the day of. We're like, hey, it's happening. And then you sign up or you don't. That's all we do with that list. We don't do anything else with it. And, of course, I follow a good email protocol anyway. Anytime you want to opt out of any list that you are on for us, you can do so. Like, we don't spam people. We don't buy lists. And we don't sell information. But if you want to learn how to build a better business and become dangerous with ChatGPT, go sign up. All right. With that, what are we going to be talking about today? Because it is an expert panel Q&A show of the week. I got a bunch of stuff for you. Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams will be talking about free markets and this concerning trend in more and more young people that seem to think socialism is some magical panacea. And the reason they think that it is because capitalism isn't a magical panacea. Dr. Paul and Dan's opinion here is pretty much that, yeah, capitalism's not perfect, but nothing's perfect, and capitalism kind of beats everything else. And Dr. Paul also takes some exception with the concept of calling what we have coming out of D.C. capitalism, because it ain't. It's It's fascism, folks. And that's not Orange Man hatred. It actually has zero to do with Orange Man. We've been basically operating under this system for a very, very long time, long before Trump ever thought about being president. In fact, before Trump was even born. I'm talking about economic fascism. I'm not talking about what the lunatics are screaming on your TV screen. In fact, those are the ones calling for socialism. Anyway, John Pugliano will talk about Masterlink and the various things like Stride, Strike, etc., derivatives of Masterlink that are all based on the Bitcoin treasury mindset that Michael Saylor has instituted. And the question for John is basically, is Strategy about to collapse? And the answer is no. And John's going to, I'll skip ahead and tell you that. John's going to tell you no. But is that a buying opportunity or is it something else? And I'm going to let you guys listen to what John has to say, and I'll tell you what I have to say. And you might think they're going to be very different. They're only going to be a little different. They're only going to be a very tiny little bit of difference in what I would say to this question and what John would say. Ryan Steva is going to talk about choosing security cameras for a homestead, keeping an eye on things that way without having somebody keep an eye on you, if you get my drift. Dr. Bones will talk about dealing with injuries to your nails. Now, I actually, when I first got this, I'm like, huh, yeah, I mean, it's something we minimize as a very superficial injury, but it made me think of a story. And I'll let Doc give you his take on this. And after Doc gives you his take, I will tell you the story of a friend of mine and how something that can look like a very superficial injury could turn into a pretty serious one in the individual case here, because we were both serving in the military at the time, and like medical care is right there. Once it became obvious, and once my knuckleheaded friend had it pointed out to him that you need to do something about it, wasn't that big a deal. But he probably would have lost his finger if he had, you know, been a civilian and been as hard-headed as he is and not had brothers around looking out for him. So I'll tell you, and the way it happened, wait till you hear it. Wait till you hear it. Just to be fair, this dude, he had a medical file after 3 years in the Army to look like he'd been in for 25 years. See, this guy, accident prone. I've actually told stories about him before. You'll get the new one today, though. Carrie Brown will talk about, should you be concerned about parasites? And if anything, what should you do about it? And he's not talking about, like, you know you have a parasitic infection. He's talking about all the hype and hysteria going on because all the influencers, right, are out talking about parasites and parasite cleanses and this herbal that and this herbal the other thing. And all of your problems are because, well, actually, no, okay, well, we'll let Carrie talk about that. And then I am going to talk about something. You are going to be shocked when I say what I'm about to say. Unless you already read the show notes, you're going to be, did Jack get a lobotomy or did he give himself one with a drill or something? Okay, but you got to hear me out and why I'm even covering this. Okay, but here it comes. Darlene Graham, which is Lindsey Graham's baby sister, who's like, I think in her 60s. Yeah, it's a lot of baby sisters in their 60s, right? She's grandma. She's a great choice for Lindsey Graham's Senate seat. What? Did Jack Spirko just say that anointing Lindsey Graham's baby 60-something-year-old sister for the Senate was a good idea? I am saying it was a good idea. I'm saying it was the most reasonable thing to do there was to do if, and if is the biggest two-letter word in the English language, if the scenario is exactly what it looks like. And not what it looks like to you, but what it looks like to the person who becomes informed before making a decision, which leads me to why I'm even doing this today. I talk all the time about systems thinking and critical thinking. And to actually do that, instead of thinking with emotion, one has to look at things like second, third, and fourth order consequences and what the alternative to the thing you're going to do looks like. Like, why didn't they appoint a really experienced politician who knows how to? Well, I'll tell you, and you'll have to wait to the anchor segment for me to do that. With that, before I bring on Dr. Paul to talk about free markets and capitalism, just a real quick capitalistic reminder, I don't hate money and I would love it, therefore, if you would buy a copy of my book, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, by me, myself, and I, Jack Spirko. I really think if you give this book a shot, you're going to love it, even if you never bought the first book. This is not like reading like Lord of the Rings, where you need to make sure you read the first book before the second. No, it's not like that at all. You can read either one of the books straight out of the gate and get plenty from it. And I will tell you, I poured my heart, my soul, and my guts into this book. It was a whirlwind journey for me to write it. It is not a biography, but there's a lot of biographical stuff in it, stories from the past and all that relate to the things that I'm trying to teach in the book. And that required me to relive a lot of, yes, triumphs and victories, but also a lot of failures and regrets and defeats, because that's how we learn. And so I took that journey, and I'm very glad that I did at this point. As I'm doing the workbooks, I'm realizing that the book, I hate to say this, but it's even better than I think it is. It really is. And it is only by examining the psychology and neuroscience behind why the laws work when applied properly in your life that makes me say that. It's not ego driving it at all. Like I said, I hate saying it, but it's a damn good book. And I really think, especially those of you who maybe are, you know, you got some people in your life a little bit younger that you think could use a little bit of a kick in the ass and a point in the right direction at the same time, they won't listen to you. Maybe, just maybe they'll listen to me, and you can spend, depending on soft cover, hard cover, like $16 or $24 and send a copy straight to their door. And even if they don't read it right away, they might. So check it out again. The book is Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul on the free market. Aren't you guys glad there's a free market? I can't just mandate my book as a textbook. It'd probably be a better textbook. But no, we're free market people around here, so let's hear about the free market and what people get wrong about it.
And the one word that has cropped up in the polling, and the polling shows that the average person, especially the young people, which is a little bit concerning to me, and that is that they're not supporting, you know, the capitalism. But when you think about it, where's this capitalism that they're not supporting? You mean that stuff we get out of Washington? It's capitalism. I don't really like the word, but basically it's supposed to mean free markets, a free exchange of goods and services, and minimal interference by the government.
We ourselves don't like this current system. You know, but we're not going to call it capitalism, because there are traces of capitalism and freedom, you know, that we're losing constantly anyway. When we advocate free markets, it's with the understanding that there is no perfection in this earthly life. Because somebody goes, oh, you want free markets? Well, what about they'll pick some obscure thing? What if that happens? Well, yeah, that's a good point. There's everything cannot be covered. You know, people have a tendency to be greedy, lazy, lie, cheat, steal. And these are internal things from the heart. Nothing that we rearrange in the external world changes that. Okay, so free markets are not a panacea for all of the problems in the world. It's just much better than centralized power, because when there are problems, when people are greedy, lazy, lie, steal, and steal, it happens locally, and it doesn't blow up the entire world. Whereas today, the lying, cheating, and stealing have been institutionalized. All the bad aspects that come from the heart are protected by the state, and nobody gets punished for anything ever, no matter how bad it is, whether it's COVID or Epstein or wars. Nobody, they feel that they're safe because they know that they are for the time being, that nobody will come after them because they would have to take down the whole system. So free markets are preferable to this. They are not the panacea. They don't get rid of lying, stealing, and cheating, but it will get rid of this.
So I think I might have said Dan as in Dan McAdams during the intro, and if I did, I apologize. That was Chris Rossini along with Dr. Paul there. And Chris, by the way, for those of you guys that are not, you know, like you get the segments here, but you don't watch Liberty Report or anything. Chris is a co-host there, but he's also the gentleman that puts these segments together for us every week. So thank you, Chris. And I completely agree with you on your assessment. I have a couple additions here, though. I'm going to say number one, the problem is the solution if the problem is properly examined. And the solution here is not adding more statism. Okay, so how is the problem the solution then? So what is the actual problem? when people say, like, you know, these people steal money, or these people extort money, or these people use, you know, some sort of extortion or some sort of monopolistic practices or something like that. What is the real problem? Well, Jack, you just said all the real problems. No, what's the real problem? What causes all that? And that is that people follow incentives, and some, you know, unethical people, the incentive to become wealthy will then follow the incentive to the point of lying, cheating, and stealing and doing very unethical things, even if they're not technically illegal, including then using the power of money through lobbying to pass laws to make things that should be illegal legal, and things that should be legal for other people to do to compete with them illegal for those people, right? Which starts to find the actual problem with the government side of it. But the actual problem then is that people are often dishonest and malicious when they are following the incentive of serving themselves above others. And people are often tempted into this. Okay, so once you know that that's the problem, then you can actually realize how stupid the proposed leftist solution is. Because the proposed leftist solution says what we should do, instead of having people over here committing these atrocious acts, where the public has a choice in who they do business with and how they do business with it. And by the way, where that party does not have special protections like qualified immunity. They don't have a monopoly on violence. What we really should do is give that same power and capability and expand it and offer a monopoly that goes along with it and move it and hand it to people that work for the state, that do live in a bubble, that do live in a cocoon, that do have a special protective dome around them, because somehow these people believe that when you give a person a government job, at least if they're the kind of government person with a job that they want them to be, they turn into an angel. And they don't do anything wrong anymore, right? That somehow they actually have this fantasy that a government employee is held to a higher standard than a private employee. Let me tell you how many people I fired that would have never got fired if they worked for any agency of government. A shitload. Because this is what happened. Oh, you did that? Okay, pack your shit, head over to HR, collect your freaking severance, and get out of my building. But now there's no but. Bye-bye. That's it. I have one time had a person that didn't want to leave, and they had access to sensitive information, and I had them physically removed. Okay? That quick. Do you know what it takes to get rid of somebody that works, I don't know, like in the mailroom at the Social Security office? Oh, my God. So the corrective action that can be taken in the private sector is much more rapid and much more of a deterrent because it can happen much more rapidly, right? But it doesn't mean that the free market will be perfect. And then we can find the real problem. We've touched on like the second layer problem, but if we want to go down to the first layer problem, the first layer problem is the expectation of perfection. The expectation that everybody should just be comfortable. Everybody should be happy. Everybody should just have the basic human rights they're entitled to, like a place to live and air conditioning and a cell phone and an Amazon app and a DoorDash app and fucking food should come to your house. That's how these people actually think. And if I want to be a woman and I'm a man, I should just be able to say it and everybody should accept it. And damn it, since not everybody will, somebody should make them. And that, in their mind, is perfection. Whatever they have is perfect in their mind. The state is not capable of delivering it to them. Here's the key, and we have to be honest about that. Neither is the free market. It is not conservatives and or libertarians, if we leave out the woke, retarded libertarians that have taken over the Libertarian Party, if we talk about real libertarians, it is neither libertarians nor conservatives who speak of platitudes of perfection. It is the left, because the left, if they speak of perfection, can always say whatever's here is bad, because it will never be perfect. It's the perfect play. That's the only perfection you get in the whole thing. Why do they think that, though? We're going to go down to like the base level reason for this. Because we live in a society where we have convinced people that every problem has a simple, easy, and applicable solution immediately available. The microwave society that I talk about. That's where we're at. So when, and it's permeated all of society. This is in my new book, by the way. But, I mean, here's an example. In the 1980s, which isn't that long ago, believe it or not, young folks, right? When I was in high school, if you wanted to go to college, okay, If you wanted to go to college, it was competitive. Even like a, like I was in Pennsylvania at the time. So like, you're kind of like your public lower tier institutions like Kutztown University or Bloomberg or something. Like, you, to get into those schools, and like, if you have like a degree in business management from Kutztown University, Pennsylvania, nobody lines up to like, hey, come talk to us over here at, you know, Goldman Sachs or something. It's not impressive. And it wasn't then either, but it was still competitive. Like, people applied and were told no. And, you know, those people ended up at, like, community college or something. If and that you even had to apply to get in. I just got an email from somebody. Their wife works for Penn State University as an admissions counselor and was counseling a new student. In fact, two new students. It turned out neither one of them even had a high school diploma, and yet they were going to Penn State. And not like a remote campus either, the little ones. No, Penn State. Like, that's not Harvard, Princeton, or Yale, but that is that's Penn State, Notre Dame. That's that level. That's that level, right? You're getting like a Rice, like, or a Baylor, right? Even though it's a state school, it's kind of got some prestige going along, or, you know, Texas A&M or something. Like, it's that level. They don't even have a high school diploma. How'd this happen? Well, we pumped a whole bunch of money into the world. We made it available through guaranteed student loans, and we went on a marketing campaign for 40 years that every child should go to college. And what that did was create a glut of people who wanted to go and could get the money to go, even though they had no idea how they were going to pay it back, and could get into the schools. So the schools expanded. Yeah? Well, then what happened? They expanded so rapidly, they exceeded the capacity of qualified students coming into college. See how that works? They outgrew the student body capacity. So, how'd that happen? Well, when people took ACTs, SATs, college entrance exams, etc., even though it was less competitive, you still had to be able to go hit like a certain, like if you have all the room in the world, but you still got to be at least this good to get in. Yeah? I mean, there were admissions requirements for community college back then. So they just kept lowering the standard and filling more and more seats. Now, what does that have to do with what we started out with? It has everything to do with it. We had a problem, and the problem was people couldn't meet a standard. And instead of saying, well, let's help people meet the standard, we lowered the standard. And I don't care where you go. This is the whole world. You get too fat, they'll give you a pill to keep you alive, and, you know, at least forestall losing your feet and your kidneys. Right. When we have kids that can't pass PT test in school, you just lower the standard. Not enough students get B's, we'll lower what a B is. Not enough students are getting at least a C, let's lower what a C is. You see, we've done this everywhere. So it's complete. Now, we've been doing this for decades, at least 40 years, with a real concerted effort to do it. So when you ask why a 16 or 22 or 25 or 26-year-old kid that's struggling would say, we need socialism to fix our capitalism problem, and you say, how can that be? I say, what else would you expect? What else would you expect? You created the illusion that somebody somewhere in power and control can wave a hand and fix a problem. I have a problem. It's not being fixed. We must have the wrong people in power. And the socialists are the ones saying they can make it perfect. And these stupid capitalists are saying live with it. What else did you expect to happen? This is why I'm going to be talking about real liberty in the future a lot more. And I'm working on a show called The Pillars of Liberty. And these are all things you can do in your own life. Because you're going to have no choice. You're going to have to build these things in your own life. Because just like you tell those dummies, no one's going to hand it to you. Well, no one's going to hand it to you either. Liberty must be taken. It must be seized. Or it's not going to happen. Let's move on and talk about something else. Investing, specifically related to Bitcoin and MicroStrategy, not just strategy, with John Pugliano.
Hello, TSP. We have a timely question from Mario. He's asking, is strategy in a death spiral, or is this a massive buying opportunity? Well, just to clarify things, he's asking about the company formerly known as MicroStrategy with ticker symbol MSTR. I'm going to give you a simple answer to a complicated question. Now, as far as the part of the question, is MicroStrategy or strategy in a death spiral? No, I don't believe it is. That answer may surprise you because, as you know, I'm not a fan of MicroStrategy. Now, to clarify, just because I say it's not going into a death spiral doesn't mean that I don't think that it's a train wreck, because from a stock performance standpoint, it has been a total disaster. Year to date, as I record this, it's down over 35%, and over the last 12 months, it's down nearly 78%, and from its all-time record high, it's down about 82%. So, no, I don't think it's in a death spiral, but it has been abysmal. The reason I say it's not in a death spiral is that a death spiral implies that eventually the price would go to zero, or at least near zero, or there'd be some kind of a bankruptcy or reorganization. I don't think that's likely, for the simple fact, and again, this is part of the argument that I've always made, even though I don't like what I consider the balance sheet engineering practices that Michael Saylor has used, my argument has been not that the company would be bankrupt or go into a death spiral, because they do have assets, right? They do have assets with their Bitcoin holdings, which overall exceed their debt level. So my argument has never been that Strategy is or would become insolvent, right? Insolvent meaning they have more debt than they have equity. They have plenty of equity. My argument has always been that they could risk a liquidity problem. Liquidity problem being, yes, they have the assets, but do they have the short-term cash to meet their current obligations? Now, if you go back earlier in the year, certainly at the start of the year, when I was making that argument, people poo-pooed my idea because they ignored the overall risk that Bitcoin could continue to go lower in price. And again, not meaning that Bitcoin's going to go to zero, but all things have cycles. It's pretty evident that Bitcoin has at least a four-year cycle. And the argument is just, you know, when does it hit a low? And my thesis has always been that, yes, as long as Bitcoin is always going up in double digits, or certainly as long as it's increasing in value higher than the dividends or the interest that Strategy is paying on its debt instruments or its debt obligations, that everything would be fine. Okay, but the risk is, what happens when Bitcoin remains stagnant, or worse yet, goes lower for a longer period of time? Now, again, I don't make any claims to know that Bitcoin has bottomed or hasn't bottomed or whatever. I can't predict the future. I just assess the risks. And so to the first part of the question, is Strategy in a death spiral? No, I don't believe so. I think they have a liquidity problem, not a solvency problem. And so this issue will get resolved at some point. I just personally don't know the point. That takes us to the next part of the question of, is this a massive buying opportunity? Well, at some point it will be a buying opportunity, and I'll fall back to, again, earlier in the year when people were asking about should they invest in Strike, which is a preferred stock that pays a dividend in excess of 10%. My argument then, again, wasn't that Strategy would go bankrupt and not be able to pay the dividend. My concern was that that dividend is so much higher than the actual market price. I mean, you consider the U.S. government on its 10-year treasury is only paying about 4.5%. And so when a company's paying 10, 11, 12%, to me, that's not an opportunity. That's a warning. That's a red flag, because it's junk bond status. Strike is not paying an excessively high dividend because Michael Saylor is a good guy and he wants to share his wealth. It's paying a 10, 11, or 12% dividend simply because it can't raise money by only offering a 7, 8, or 9% dividend. In any case, high dividends like that are a warning sign to me. And had you bought into the security of receiving that dividend, you know, back earlier in the year, saying, you know, in January when the year started out, yes, you would be receiving your dividend. But look at the stock price itself. As I record this, Strike, the preferred stock price, is down by more than 11.5%. So yes, you're receiving a dividend payment, but you also lost in excess of 11% of your principal. So is this a massive buying opportunity? Well, in terms of Strategy, whether you're talking about the actual company stock or any of its derivative preferred stock instruments, their major asset wealth is all based on Bitcoin. And so it comes down to the Bitcoin price. When Bitcoin bottoms, then Strategy stock price will also likely bottom. So if you think the worst of the Bitcoin winter is over, yes, this could be a buying opportunity. On the other hand, if you think the Bitcoin's going lower, then no, this wouldn't be the time to buy Strategy. Because remember, the whole concept of the way this works is that it's leveraged to take advantage of the fact of rising Bitcoin prices. The stock price of Strategy goes up faster than Bitcoin, And likewise, when Bitcoin goes lower, Strategy's stock price goes even lower. Bottom line, for me and my money, I think there's too much financial engineering involved with the whole Bitcoin treasury concept. I think I'd be more likely to sell my kidneys than invest in Strategy. Hey, that's a little paraphrase on what Michael Saylor has said in the past. In any case, it's too risky for me, but I will say this. Bitcoin itself has been hovering just at or below or a little above its four-year moving average. The way I look at the Bitcoin charts, anytime Bitcoin is below its four-year average, it tends to be a good entry point. Again, the question being, will it just go down to the four-year moving average, or as it had during the winter of 2022, will it go significantly below that four-year moving average? Bottom line, it hasn't dropped low enough to interest me, but I do keep my eye on it. So hey, again, just my opinion. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Study Podcast.
So I want to, like I said, I only disagree a little bit. Now, the whole, you know, the only reason they're paying a high dividend is so they can attract the money is kind of sort of true. And then junk bond status, I completely disagree with that. Junk bond status is generally the case. We'll pay this really high interest rate, not only because we can't get the money, but because we're a bad bet. And you kind of know it's a bad bet, but you're going to make it anyway because the odds, you know, are stacked towards you if it even remotely succeeds. You know? Well, to say that Strike, Strive, MicroStrategy, any of the derivatives there are bad bets, then you're saying that Bitcoin itself is a bad bet. Because the one thing John got completely right here is the equity situation, and they have enough equity to pay the dividends. In fact, they have enough equity in cash alone to pay all the dividends, not Bitcoin equity, cash equity to pay the dividends until March next year. Just if nothing else happens, if they don't raise any more, if everything stays exactly the way it is and Bitcoin crashes another 50%, which it won't, it might go down more. More on that in a minute, right? But if it went down another 50%, they could still pay the dividends. So not only do they have this, I mean, you're talking about like 36 years if they were relying on the Bitcoin equity at like $40,000 of Bitcoin, much lower than it is right now. So we're not even talking about that side of things. We're just talking about cash on hand. Now, Saylor recently liquidated a few million dollars worth of Bitcoin and was very clear about why. He said, we just proved that we'll do it. We proved that we can do it. We proved that it can work, and therefore we can now raise more money and buy more Bitcoin while it's going down. To me, that is a very sound financial strategy. And the other thing he pointed out is if you look over like the last 30 days when we sold the frickin' Bitcoin, we bought more than we sold. Oh, and when we sell it and then buy it back, it's doing the same thing I taught you guys to do for the last 15 years. Since it went down since we bought it, and everyone thinks we're stupid, you know, buy high and sell low. When there's no wash rule, do that all the time. We take the tax loss, and we pay the dividend, and we buy more back than we had. And we create a new lower basis for it. This is sound strategy. Interesting name of the company, isn't it? Strategy. Okay, so, but the takeaway he comes away with, which is it a buying opportunity? He's like, it's not interesting to me right now. I'll tell you straight up. I don't own Masterlink, and I don't own any of the stocks that were built off its back, like Stride, Strives, etc. And I'm maybe going to do a show next week where it's kind of a multi-part show, and I might dig into, like, why would you buy something like Strike with an 11% interest rate instead of just buying Bitcoin? We'll talk about that next week because there's some very good reasons you might do this, okay? And I want to also point out, not only are they paying the dividends, but you're getting the same dividends you would if the strike price on the stock didn't go down or up. So somebody that bought $100,000 worth of Strike, STRIC, right, the STRC, I'm sorry, not Strike the app, Strike the stock, and it's making like 11.5% right now. That means that their annual dividends on $100,000 that they put in is $11,500 that they pay no tax on. I'm not going to get into exactly how that works because eventually they will pay tax if they liquidate the investment or some other things. The fact that the equity value went down doesn't affect the dividend because it's a preferred dividend. So if I'm a pensioner and I put in – I don't know, $1 million even. And I'm getting $111,000, $110,000 a year in tax-free income for about the next 10 years. And it doesn't matter if the price went from $100 strike price to 90 or 88 or whatever. I get the same money. You understand that, right? So it's so all the people that are bought in don't care because they bought in for dividend flow. Now, what I think is going to happen though, and this, if you want to buy stocks, may give you a real opportunity here with the MasterLink stock, not the strike or stride, because the dividends are fixed based on the investment. So I guess if you buy it cheaper, you can get the equity gain too. I think Bitcoin is going to continue to drop and will probably not bottom until sometime around Thanksgiving. I am putting the bottom price prediction in, and I've done this for several months now, and I haven't changed it yet. $35,000 to $45,000 will be the bottom, and it will probably happen in Q4. Why? Because that's what always happens. Somebody just asked on the blog, how is that possible? All these different things are going on. It's happened over and over and over and over again. You know what else is going on? A crisis, right? BIP 110. Don't worry. If you don't know what it means, don't worry. It's just a bunch of Bitcoiners making retard noises at each other is all it really is. There's always a crisis in this cycle at this time, every time. It always helps drive the price down. It's part of a natural cycle. And then it always turns around and melts your face in the next year, year and a half, and reaches new all-time highs. So that's what I think is going to happen again. So if you wanted to buy the stock or buy into one of these interest-bearing accounts, you might want to wait a little bit longer. However, or even Bitcoin, right? And if you had a lump sum right now, say, I think I'm going to put like $500,000 into Bitcoin or Stride or whatever, like unless you can really articulate why, it's probably not a good idea. But I would tell you, like, between now and, like, February, I would divide the number of days that you have by the amount of money you have, and I'd make that a daily buy, or I'd do it as a weekly buy. Because timing the bottom is a fool's race. It's like trying to catch a falling knife, and you almost never pull it off. And this is why dollar-cost averaging is so effective. You buy the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, the ups, the centers. But when you know you're in a bottom point of a cycle, it goes on steroids. So I would take that approach personally. I would not pile a ton of money into Master right now. And I definitely wouldn't do it with options in like a short term. Because I think if you try to do like a 90-day play using options with MSTR right now, you are very likely going to get the shit burned out of you. Just that's me speaking. Anyway, let's talk about security cameras with Kerry Brown. Real quick, scratch that. Kerry's up two more spots ahead. I'll talk about parasites. This is actually Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva. So today I initially had a question from Jack that was about video cameras for predator protection. And I kind of flippantly sent back an email saying, I don't have a great answer for this. The answer that I used to have isn't a great option anymore. And I realized after doing a little bit of research that I was wrong. And so I'm going to do this segment to try to talk with people about what they could use different security cameras for and what cameras, especially or specifically for livestock, would actually be useful in this given situation. The question is, we are on a one-acre property in a rural area with lots of predators, and we would like some sort of camera system to keep our animals safe. I'd prefer something that we didn't have to pay a monthly service fee for. All right, so I am definitely going to answer this question the best that I can, but I would be remiss as a homestead consultant and as somebody who loves permaculture to not help ask some questions. I'll probably do this at the end of why do you want this system and are there any alternative options that might work better based on your goals and needs? But first, I'm just going to answer their question and then we'll go into that. So my initial response to Jack was I used to recommend Blink, but now they appear to be part of the Flock system, and I was actually wrong about that. Blink cameras are owned by Amazon, but Amazon has actually canceled its partnership that it was planning with Flock Safety. So for now, they're not part of that, but I would just keep that in mind that with it being an Amazon company and them having had intention of doing that, and it was specifically with their Ring doorbells, but I would assume Blink would be close behind. So just keep that in mind if you do end up going with the Blink systems, that that's something you should watch out for, is potential future integration there. So the benefits of the Blink cameras is, one, they're very inexpensive. Two, they use LoRa, which is a long-range radio protocol that allows you to put them further away from the building or the house or wherever you might have Wi-Fi, because they talk on a different frequency at a further distance than Wi-Fi typically would allow you to go. And they run exclusively on battery. They'll run about 1 to 2 years on one set of batteries. So they have some really great benefits. The problem here is that they don't send you a notification quite as quickly as you should or as you might want with a more traditional system, because with the LoRa or long-range radio and the way they're set up, they essentially have to boot back up really quickly to send you the notification and to get you the video footage. So keep that in mind. But they do have a local recording option, so that you just put a flash drive in a local hub, and it allows you to watch or to record video from there. So there's no subscription necessary. You can actually watch those videos remotely on your phone as well. And you can set it up to send you notifications, and you can alarm or disarm the system, so it will or won't send you notifications depending on what you want at the given time. Another newer system, and I'm probably saying the name wrong, but is EufyCam, E-U-F-Y-C-A-M. Now, this is a company that is part of the Anker family, and we all know that Anker makes pretty good stuff overall and stands behind their products. This one looks pretty good as well. It's not nearly as inexpensive as the Blink, and it's not going to go as far because it is Wi-Fi dependent, but it has some major benefits. First of all, you're going to get true 4K cameras. Secondly, is that those cameras they come with a built-in solar panel on the camera itself, and that should keep the camera as charged as it needs to be. It has local storage and recording, so you don't have to pay for a subscription. But the big thing with this camera system is it has a two-stage PRI motion detection and radar detection system. And so the camera will actually turn on when it notices motion. And then it has a built-in like smart recognition. So once it turns on, it will look and see if the thing that it's looking at is something that you want alerts for. And you can actually set it up to alert for like a dog or certain animals. So I don't know if it's going to get as granular as things like raccoons or possums or whatever, but it does have like animal and vehicle and pet and human recognition. So you can filter some things out and you'll get a lot less false alerts. And the other benefit here is its motion range is approximately 40 feet, which is a fairly long motion detection range for these systems. An additional benefit is that these cameras have a really special, very cool technology that allows for color nighttime image without giant spotlights. So it's, from what I've seen, it's actually a really great technology that gives you a lot more data, even at night, which is when you're going to be concerned about predators. There's also the RioLink Home Hub with Argus 4 Pro cameras. The big benefit here is that the solar panels for the cameras are detached. So if your camera is going where you're going to have shade, you can put the panel out where it makes more sense or where the sun's going to be. But some of the things like the smart detection are not included on this. So it's going to give you a lot more false positives. And then finally, you could use something like a YoLink with motion sensors. It's LoRa, so it's a long-range radio. It gives you instant alerts. YoLink has alert hubs that will actually sound an alert in your house if you want it to. It can be programmed to trigger any response, so it can turn on all the outdoor floodlights. It could do various things if you want that, but that's motion sensing only. But I like the YoLink system a lot, and I use it for a lot of builds, which I think I've talked about before on the program. I'll drop links for Jack to add in the show notes if you're interested in any of those items. And then finally, the last thing I want to talk about is just security in general against predators. A lot of times, building the systems better rather than relying on technology is going to be your best bet. I love having what I call a dog moat, which is a perimeter fence that keeps your dog in. That may even just be an invisible fence, which don't have to be invisible. You can run a line like on T-posts that is used for your invisible fence, so you don't have to bury it. and then having your inside perimeter, so another fence around, say, your chicken coop and run, or other areas, garden or whatever. And so you've got a dog that's outside that's in between those two things. It's a dog moat, as I call it. But there are a lot of things that you can do, automatic doors on your chicken coops, other options that may actually provide you much higher security without the reliance on the technology. So just keep that in mind. What are your actual goals and what could you actually do with this? But the technology oftentimes can fail, or you can miss an alert, or you can sleep through it, or the alert might be too late anyways for you to get your shotgun and get out to the chicken coop. So just keep all these things in mind that there may be a better way to do this. If you want to do this correctly, I would highly recommend thinking through other ways that you can secure your animals before you turn to the high-tech solution. All right, thanks everybody, and thanks for the question. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me at thehomesteadconsultant.com.
I won't add anything to that directly or critique it anyway, because I think it's a great answer. He did mention a lot of different products and options as well, and I have all of those for you linked in today's show notes, the Blink camera, the Yolink Motion, and all that other stuff. The only thing I would say is that we are getting better and better with networked game cameras, and so that also might be an option. That puts you in a completely autonomous mode in that there's no mothership, there's no cloud. And so, you know, that may look at, you might have to be doing some sort of outdoor rated network extender or something to make sure that they can get on your network. Because it seems to me that the reason he's going this route, the gentleman asked the question, is because some of these game cameras and whatnot actually have cellular capabilities and they have a fee, so that when you put them out in the deer woods somewhere in the middle of nowhere, that you could actually access them. When you're on your own homestead, you know, and I've seen people with a lot of network extenders linked out and having network capability, you know, across acres and acres of land. The TP Deco line has some stuff that works like that. I run TP Deco for my office and home, inside, outside, though the stuff I'm running is, you know, it has to be protected from the elements to a degree, and it's pretty expensive, the particular setup I have, but they make some lower cost options, and with a little bit of protection and a little bit of some backup power, you can run a pretty damn good contained land network, and you don't really have to worry about who makes the equipment then. All right, with that, let's go ahead and, again, some of the game cameras now are pretty badass for that. And they also often come with their own apps and directly work with your phone and everything else. So let's now talk about something else. Let's talk about dealing with an injury to a nail, like your fingernail, toenail, et cetera. And then I'll tell you, I don't know if it was funny then, even though we laughed at him and mocked him, but it's definitely funny now. Story about a friend of mine who's just a wee bit accident prone.
Hi, Joe Altman here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net. Co-author of the Book Excellence Award winner in medicine, the fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, plus designer of quality medical kits at altonfirstaid.com. Today I'd like to talk about an injury that's pretty common, but you rarely hear about it. Trauma to a nail, usually a toenail or thumbnail, is a minor injury, but can occasionally become a major handicap for a member of a survival group, especially off the grid. Usually due to blood accumulation under the nail, that's called a subungual hematoma, or due to infection if the skin or nail bed is torn, they can be a big problem. Nail bed injuries are common, and they're going to be more so when survivors are required to chop wood, do carpentry tasks, or other activities to which they're not accustomed. A decrease in work efficiency is a decrease in a group's chances for survival long term. Let's talk about nail anatomy. Your fingernails and toenails are made up of protein and a tough substance known as keratin. They are, as you might imagine, similar to the claws of animals. When we refer to issues involving nails, we refer to it as ungual, from unguis, which is the Latin word for claw. The nail consists of several different parts. The nail plate, or body, this is a hard covering of the end of your finger or toe, and what you could generally consider to be your nail. The nail bed, which is the skin directly under the nail plate, that's made up of an upper and lower layer of epidermis and dermis, just like the rest of your skin. The superficial epidermis moves along the nail plate as it grows. Vertical grooves attach the superficial epidermis to the deep dermis. In older people, the nail plate thins out and you can see vertical grooves if you look closely. As with all skin, blood vessels and nerves run through the nail bed. The nail matrix, the portion or root at the base of the nail that produces new cells for the nail plate. You can see a portion of the matrix in the light half moon, known as the lunula, visible at the base of the nail plate. This determines the shape and thickness of the nail. A curved matrix produces a curved nail, a flat one produces a flat nail. And then there's the cuticle, which is the thickened layer of skin surrounding fingernails and toenails. New living cells in the cuticle are known as the eponychium. Let's talk about nail trauma. The nail plate may be ripped off by some form of trauma. This is known as a nail avulsion. The nail may be partially or completely gone, or may just be lifted up off of the nail bed. Ordinarily, depending on the type of trauma, an x-ray would be performed to rule out a fracture of the digit. You won't have this tool available without modern facilities, but you may still need to intervene. You'll numb the area if local anesthesia is available. If not, then you just got to keep going. Clean the nail bed thoroughly with saline solution and irrigate out any debris. You can make sterile saline solution at home, by the way. You begin with a liter of water in a pan with a lid. Add 2 teaspoons of salt. Place a lid on the pan and bring the salt water to a boil for, let's say, a minute or two. And then let the solution cool in the pan with the lid on. Then you pour the solution into sterile jars or use it immediately. After that, you paint with betadine, which is a 2% povidone iodine solution, or some other kind of antiseptic. Finally, you cover the exposed and very sensitive nail bed with a non-adherent dressing. Some people add petroleum jelly for additional protection. You want to change this dressing frequently and avoid ordinary gauze. You want non-stick gauze. Ordinary gauze will stick tenaciously to the nail bed and be painful to remove. If the nail bed is hanging by a thread, you probably should remove it by separating it from the skin folds using a small surgical clamp. You can consider placing the loose nail plate on the nail bed as a protective covering. It's dead tissue, but may be the most comfortable option. Avoid scraping or clipping off loose edges, as it may affect the nail bed's ability to heal. If a nail bed is lacerated, suture it once cleaned with the thinnest absorbable suture available, such as a 6-0 Vicryl PGA. Suture closure is described in our books and on our YouTube channel. That's Dr. Bones, Nurse Amy. Place a dressing over the wound. It would be wise to immobilize the digit with a padded finger splint to protect it from further damage. You might begin a course of antibiotics if the nail bed was contaminated with debris or torn in some other way. Amoxicillin or cephalexin are appropriate options. In some crush injuries, such as the classic whacking the nail plate with a hammer, a bruise, also called an ecchymosis, or a collection of blood called a hematoma, may form underneath. A bruise will be painful, but the worst pain should subside within an hour or two. A hematoma, however, will continue to be painful even hours or days after the event. A bruise will likely appear brownish or blue, while a hematoma may appear a deep blue-black. For a bruised nail, little needs to be done other than giving some oral pain meds, maybe ibuprofen. But for a significant hematoma, pain may increase as blood accumulates under pressure. Some suggest a further procedure called trephination. In this instance, a very fine drill or a hot 18-gauge needle or even a paperclip is used to make a hole in the nail plate. The opening must be large enough to allow the blood that is collected under the nail to escape. You may need several holes. Once the pressure is relieved, the pain will feel better almost immediately. Foot baths are usually used to allow more of the blood to drain out. This procedure should not be performed unless absolutely necessary, of course, as the pain will eventually decrease over time on its own. If you go too deep through the nail, you may further injure the nail bed. Make sure to keep the injured finger dry, splinted, and bandaged for a minimum of at least 48 hours afterwards. It's important to realize that damage to the base of the nail, the matrix that is, may be difficult to completely repair, and that future nail growth may be deformed in some way. In situations where modern medical care is available, a hand surgeon is often called in to give the injury the best chance to heal appropriately. Even then, a higher incidence of issues such as ingrown nails may occur over time. A completely torn off nail may take 4 to 5 months to grow back, maybe even longer. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about wounds and wound care in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
Okay, here's an example of why this has to be taken seriously. And the guy that I'm about to tell you a story at his own expense was a wee bit accident prone, as I said. And it, just to give you some examples, he gave himself a concussion with a crescent wrench trying to take the lid off a master cylinder underneath a military trailer. So he had both of his feet on the frame of the trailer, pulling as hard as he can. And when it finally gave, he hit himself right between the eyes and knocked himself out. A few weeks after that, he stabbed himself in the head with a screwdriver trying to get a cotter pin out of a trailer's brake cable. It seems like him and trailers didn't get along. He almost destroyed his knee jumping off of one truck and hitting the pumpkin on the front wheel of another. And it just goes on. I'm not going to go on. And I tell you this because there's maybe a lesson in it for you if you have a friend like this. I think part of why what happened that I'm going to tell you next happened is because we ragged on the guy so hard for, you know, basically living at the medical clinic. He didn't want to have to go back. So one day he's working on, it was either a 5-ton or a deuce and a half, and he's sitting in the seat, either driver or passenger, I don't remember which, but he puts his hand on the top of the window frame and just opens the door to get out of it. And when he did that, he crimped his pointer finger, the fingernail, between the door frame and the mirror or the mirror frame on the next truck, and it hurt like a pinch. We've all done this, right? And it hurt. It got a little black and blue, and it's not that big a deal or whatever, except that his finger starts to swell. And finally, we're like, Brad, dude, you need to go to the medics and take a look at that, right? But he doesn't do it. We think he does, but he doesn't. And a couple days later, I noticed that his finger looks worse. It's now more swollen. And then I catch him trying to lance it himself, and he's stabbing himself with a pin that hopefully he sterilized, but nothing's coming out. Like, you can tell there is pus in there. He can't get it to come out. So I'm finally like, all right, look, you're in a clinic, man. He's like, I don't work for you or whatever. We're like, you know, co-equals. And I'm like, I don't give a shit. You're going. And I'm taking you there, because the clinic was like just at the end of our barracks building. Like, you're going there, and I'm going to make sure you go there, or we're going to talk to the sergeant, and he's going to make you go. So wouldn't it be better if you just went? So I walk down there with him, and the medic looks at it immediately. He just shakes his head. And they end up injecting him with a bunch of freaking lidocaine or novocaine or some shit so that he won't feel anything. They put, you know, a little surgical towel over, rolling your finger sticks out, and they tell him, you probably don't want to look at this. He goes, it doesn't hurt now. I don't care. Well, he ended up passing out. Like, one of the girls caught his head so he didn't bang his head when he saw what they were doing. They cut his fingernail vertically, drilled holes into it, shimmed it up, and put it in some sort of drain to get this to actually drain, because what had happened, the cuticle had been driven inside somehow, and it had compartmentalized the infection. It was also infecting the tip of the bone of the finger. And I'm going to tell you again, the way this happened, all he did was open a door and pinch his finger. He just, and again, I know the man is prone to doing things like this, hit it exactly the wrong way perfectly. But the point is, these can be serious injuries if not cared for. And as long as you can run to a clinic or a hospital or an ER, it's not a big deal. But knowing how to do things like you just heard from Doc can be really important, because we don't have to have the end of the world. We don't have to have the zombie apocalypse to have to go a couple weeks or longer without higher level medical care. I've lived through a few instances of my life in this just from ice storms, for example. So, good stuff from Doc, and he took that one on his own, and he hit a home run as far as I'm concerned. Now let's hear about parasites from Kerry Brown, this time for real.
Hey, TSP community. It's Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources, and today I'm going to answer a question that Larry sent in. Larry wrote in and said, this question's for Kerry Brown, but I'd love for it to go to Dr. Bones as well for a traditional medical and natural health perspective. And he writes, what are the actual risks with parasites, and what are some effective treatments? Details, the last few years, influencers, actual physicians, and health content creators have spoken greatly about parasites, making it seem like everyone has parasites. Should I presume that a majority of people have parasites? What is the actual risk to a typical North American of having parasites that are impacting the quality of life, and what are effective testing and treatment methodologies? There seem to be a lot of parasite cleanses, but what considerations should I make in choosing a treatment course, if any? Some additional risk factors: I eat rare steaks, occasional sushi, and work on a goat farm where presumably parasites are more active, and I would like to know. Well, Liz came through kind of at an interesting time because I've been a bit of a deep dive lately on parasites, mostly because I too noticed that all of a sudden it's all over the internet. And I've been around long enough that I remember when certain things seem to capture the collective conscience of, you know, whether it be candida, mold, you name it. Open up any natural health book from the 70s on, and there's all kinds of stuff out there to strike up concern in the population, and maybe even possibly in an effort to sell product and make money. And I'll even confess that about 2 years ago, I even did a parasite cleanse. I know because I looked it up. The company that provided the kit that I purchased, which was several hundred dollars, was Rogers Hood. And I'm not saying their kit is good or bad or anything about the company. It was recommended to me by another local healthcare practitioner because I just had a number of just kind of vague symptoms that I couldn't really pin down to anything else. Had cleaned up my diet, addressed all sorts of things, had all normal labs and all that kind of good stuff. And I thought, what the heck? I'll give it a try. And I'll tell you what, I did the whole kit cleanse and everything and followed the protocol quite stringently. And yeah, not much to report in the way of how I felt. So I'll run down with some bullet points here in just a minute, but I'm going to kind of take a middle road on this, in my opinion. This opinion time here. I do not think parasites are nearly as prevalent as people on the internet would perhaps make you believe here in, a developed country like America, like a lot of places. Now, if we're talking about places where perhaps cleanliness is not valued as much, water treatment is not effective or is absent altogether, where things happen that include, you know, human feces winding up on fresh produce, things that, you know, just there's always a chance, right? And I'm not saying it can't happen here. I think it's low on the list of things to worry about, even if currently in the news they're trying to push this narrative about I'm not going to remember the name of the parasite, but the kind that gives you not just diarrhea but explosive diarrhea. So let's get into a few points here, because I kind of dug around on this more and distilled it down, and this is kind of my take on it currently. Parasites are real, but they're not ubiquitous. Like I was saying, most healthy North Americans do not generally have a clinically significant parasite infection, despite what social media often suggests. And I'm going to pause here for a minute, because you may have seen the pictures or video of things that have potentially been expelled from a person's body. And unless you are taking that sample to a lab and getting it tested and using microscopy and all that kind of stuff, you don't know that that's what it is. It could be intestinal lining, it could be mucus, it could be all sorts of things, but it doesn't mean that it's a parasite. And I find it very interesting that before I consider any kind of parasite treatment on my animals, I send off a fecal sample to a vet to look for eggs or segments or anything that could indicate parasites. So why aren't we doing this for ourselves? So going on, risk depends upon your exposure. international travel, untreated water, poor sanitation, certain raw foods, and specific occupational exposures, including some farm work, can increase your risk. But most livestock parasites are species-specific and don't even readily infect humans. You've probably heard of what they call an end stage or a I think I might be missing the phrase here at the moment, but a dead end animal. That's when you bring other animals in with your livestock, and if the parasite gets on board that animal, it cannot replicate itself, and so it's a way of reducing parasite exposure to your livestock overall. Like most cows can't get sheep parasites, and chickens can't get sheep parasites, and so people will pair some cows and chickens with a flock and reduce the overall risk. Symptoms alone are not enough to go on. Fatigue, brain fog, bloating, digestive issues. These are very common. They can be attributed to any number of things. And so by themselves, they're not a poor they are a poor indicator of a parasite infection. I would only go to thinking about parasites if you have truly exhausted all other avenues. Unless you feel that you have had something that has given you a significant exposure. And a lot of these content creators and such, they kind of seem to forget that we have an immune system and it provides substantial protection. Healthy people are constantly exposed to potential pathogens, and the body has all kinds of digestive barriers and immune defenses that'll prevent many parasite exposures and keep that from becoming an established infection. And also worth keeping in mind, most creatures carry some level of a parasite load. It doesn't mean it's making you sick. There's even a little bit of evidence with certain forms of parasite that there's actually a little bit of a symbiotic. They have been used in studies to activate an immune response from a sluggish immune system to deal with a separate issue. It's kind of up there. It's not exactly the same, but you might have heard of fecal transplantation. It's actually a thing now to collect fecal samples from very, very, very healthy people and put them on board an individual who has become very sick with usually some kind of digestive illness or some kind of bacterial illness like C. diff. When their beneficial gut flora has just been absolutely decimated. And that's a real thing. And if you have, if you are very healthy, there is actually a company that will purchase your poo. I signed up for it once and they turned me down because I didn't check all the boxes for a healthy patient, unfortunately. So diagnosis needs to come before treatment. We do this with almost everything else, right? And, you know, I know we have a lot of criticisms of Western medicine and so forth right now, but there's still something to be said for the actual scientific process and the actual diagnostic pathway to obtain some answers and get some data points before we just start throwing all kinds of, whether it's herbs or meds or so forth. If we're critical of doctors for doing that, then we need to be just as critical of a natural healthcare provider if they're not following some kind of diagnostic pathway. So you've got stool PCR panels that can be performed, stool OVA and parasite exams, and other targeted tests that are more reliable than assuming a parasite is present based on nonspecific symptoms or just photos of your poop. The herbal parasite cleanses have limited clinical evidence, and I would argue that maybe it's just because there hasn't been enough studies, and there should be, because I am a believer in natural medicines, and you know, if my sheep know enough to forage certain plants because they know it shores up their immune system and provides micronutrients and helps them you know, keep a healthy gut biome and so forth, then that is real and shouldn't be dismissed outright. Right now there's just little high quality evidence that these commercial parasite cleanses, herbal cleanses, reliably handle the issue. So if you were to be actually diagnosed with a parasite, I wouldn't think twice about just getting on fenbendazole or ivermectin or whatever the appropriate course of action may be. And then finally, I'd like to avoid the one hidden cause mindset. again, with your things like parasites, mold, candida, heavy metals, all these are real under the right circumstances, but they're often really overgeneralized as explanations for a wide range of symptoms without sufficient evidence. An exposure history, objective testing, and an evidence-based treatment plan remain the most reliable approach. And that is in my complete layman's opinion, with a little bit of research that I have been into lately. Like I said, I saw the internet taking off on all this stuff. And anytime the internet gets obsessed about something, unless it's some kind of celebrity silliness, I like to dig down a little bit further and see what's actually going on. So Larry and everybody else, I hope that is useful to you guys. Reach out to me if I can help you with any of your homestead planning, land study, permaculture design, and so forth on your land. And I am happy to say that I am in the middle of a sheep video series. I'm going to be putting a video series together. It's everything I've learned over these last few years of running sheep. And I'm going to have it pulled together as an introductory to intermediate video course that'll be helpful to you guys if you're looking into getting hair sheep to take care of your property and to feed your family. So thank you so much, and I will talk to you guys next time.
You know, if you go back 20 years, no one was even talking about this, worried about this, whatever. And if you go back 10 years, very few people were talking about this or worried about this. And today, there's a lot of people worried about this, and it's a direct result of social media influencers. So how did social media influencers become the diagnostic equipment of the country versus the medical establishment? Well, of course, the medical establishment destroyed all credibility, and what little credibility they had left about 2019, by the time we got to 2021, 2022, I ain't going to say what happened, but you know what happened. They had none. There is not a person right now who is self-thinking and has an IQ over 85 that trusts the medical establishment. If you're like, but I trust them, I don't know why you're listening to this show then, because I don't think you're ready for the things we talk about. Because you are a dumbass, right? So you have a weakened medical establishment. So then I have to look somewhere else. The problem with looking to like Instafluencers and shit like that is all those people are going to do is follow incentives. And the incentive is, what is the thing that if I talk about it right now will get eyeballs on me? That's it. That's the entire incentive for them. So when something becomes a thing, then everybody talks about it. Then all of a sudden it feels like, well, it's everywhere. And it's basically an unplanned psyop. You don't have a parasite problem. And if you do, you'll probably know it. Okay. And like he said, we don't treat our animals for parasites without having them tested for parasites, because then we know what parasite they have and we know what treatment to match. And then the beauty of being an influencer, right, an instafluencer, is that you can, you know, say things like, hey, I heard about all these herbal shits. Here's the link in my bio or that company paid you. You're not diagnosing a medical condition. You said you heard about it. And basically, you're staying just outside the danger zone of trying to practice medicine. And you can make a lot of money doing it. So that's why you don't have a parasite problem. And if you do, you probably know it. All right. Moving on. Let's talk about something. My segment's going to be – I've talked a lot today in between segments. So my segment's going to be kind of short. But it is a segment designed to help you process the concept of systems thinking and critical thinking. And to do that, you have to first establish the actual baseline, not the one that you're emotionally reacting to. And then you have to think of like second, third, fourth order consequences. So Darlene Graham, and her real name is something else. She was married and she has a married name, but her maiden name, I guess, is Graham, is Lindsey Graham's little sister. And I guess she's old. She ain't old. Damn well better not call her old. I'm in my 50s. She's 62. But I don't refer to somebody who's 62 years old as a little sister, I guess, unless they were mine, right? Like, I'm not referring to somebody else's 62-year-old sister as his little sister, right? It's childish. So it's a little play going on there. But Darlene Graham was appointed by the governor of South Carolina to sit in Lindsey Graham's Senate seat through the end of the year, basically, because we have an election coming up. Now, legally, what happens when a senator dies in office? Whatever state that senator is in, the governor of that state names someone to sit in for them. They don't leave the seat open in the interim while they organize a special election. Why? Because there's 435 Congress clowns in the House. There's only 100 senators. Missing one is a 1% loss. And if you have a tight Senate, which we do, it can actually sway a vote just by having one person not available. And so the concept there is there's too much riding on that seat for it to sit empty. So the solution is you let the governor appoint somebody to the seat. And I will also remind you that we used to appoint senators to begin with from the legislature, and that usually meant that the governor and the appointee, you know, once we change that, would generally be of the same party. And in this case, it is. So the idea is that since it was a Republican-held seat in a Republican state, the seat stays Republican while the voters decide what they want, which they would have had to wait to do anyway. Got it? Okay, so that's the situation around. So the idea that somebody gets appointed to the Senate, there was many people I saw on social media very offended by that. That's the law. That is the system. There is no plan B. There is no option. The governor can't sit there and go, I'm not going to do it. I think it's wrong, so I'm not going to do it. Okay? So then the other argument was, but she has no experience in politics. Okay? Yeah, so? Here's the thing. What happens next? Before we get mad, people act like she was just coronated to the crown of the queen or something, right? She gets a Senate seat for about, what, 6 months? 5 months? 5.5 months? Half of which time they won't even be in session. So who gets the seat long term? Who takes the, because Lindsey was up for re-election this year, which he probably would have won. In November, who runs? Not her. Not yet anyway. What has to happen next is they have to have, this is the law as well. This is not an opinion. This is, I don't like it. Well, you don't like the law. Okay, we're talking about things have to be done a certain way under the law, especially with elections. Under the law, the state is required to convene a special election very quickly. How quickly? Well, I'm glad you asked. That's a good question to ask. Good job. That would be August 11th. It's July 16th. This election is going to happen on August 11th. And we'll know if everything is as it looks to be by July 28th. So we're talking, what, 12 days. And we'll probably know by about July 21 to 24, 25, because if it's going to happen a different way, you'll probably know by then. What am I talking about? So right now, anybody that wants to can file to run in that election. And they have to get their shit together and they have to put their packet in between July 21 and July 28. And then you only have like 2 weeks and you have the election. That's how long it is to run here. Okay? And when I keep saying if it's as it looks, here's how it looks. Darlene Graham has no interest in running. She has no chance of winning if she were to do so. No one knows who the hell she is. And the time period is too compressed for someone like her to mount an actual campaign to win a special election that fast. You see how that works? She has no political experience. She has no war chest. She gets Lindsey Graham's. No, she doesn't. So you don't see people that say that. You don't know anything about election law. You have a strong opinion about a thing you know nothing about. So when a candidate dies in office, their war chest doesn't just get handed to somebody else. She doesn't get all his campaign money that he has built up. She could theoretically get access to his human network if they wanted her. And the party or some big group of donors could come in and fund that relatively short term and try to keep the seat for her. If she had political ambitions, which she's never shown a single inkling of a political ambition in her life. So what does this mean? This means that there's about three or four potential candidates that are most likely to get that seat that you probably will hear all or two of the three I'm about to give you announce that week that they are running. And those top potential, I'll give you everybody that even has a shot at this. Ralph Norman is probably the guy that's going to take this seat. Not only get the I mean, South Carolina is going to go Republican 99%. So you're probably looking at Representative Ralph Norman. Another potential person would be Mark Lynch, who challenged Graham in the primary. A long shot, but possible, would be Representative Nancy Mace. Lieutenant Governor Pamela Everett is a potential, polling at about 10%. Rep. Russell Fry polling about 10%. And the governor who made the appointment is polling at like 7.7%. But my view is if he decided he wanted this, he would become a very strong candidate like overnight. Okay? It's going to probably be one of those people. And if I had to put money on it, I would tell you it's between Norman and Everett. Those would be my best guesses. And Lynch is a distant third. Those are my three predictions. Now, why does all this matter and how does this play into systems thinking? So let's say that the people that are shrieking, they should take somebody with experience. Okay. Ralph Norman has experience. Mark Lynch has experience. Nancy Mace has experience. Pamela Everett has experience. You know what they all are? Ambitious politicians. If you hand it to one of them, there is no doubt if they were, I might go for it. I'm doing it now, right? And the minute you pick one, you're kind of a kingmaker or a queenmaker. Do you see what I'm saying? This is how we ended up with people like freaking, now not exactly the same way, but very much the same vein, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, probably the two worst other than John Thune Republicans in the Senate. Just awful. Vote with the Democrats probably about half the time. Okay? That's how you end up with this shit. So that's why you would think that I would be opposed to Darlene, right? Okay, but she doesn't want the job. So if I'm the governor and I put Mark Lynch up, I just basically handed Mark Lynch the nomination. If I put Nancy Mace, I pretty much handed her. Any of these people that I told you are possible, if I am Governor McMaster and I appoint them, I've pretty much just put my thumb on the scale as to who the nominee is going to be. The cleanest thing for me to do is to pick someone who will simply say, I will vote the way I believe Lindsey Graham would have voted because that's who the people elected until the end of the term, and I'm out. That's what it looks like Darlene is. Again, if I put somebody in who's more qualified, that means more ambition. Ambitious, that means wants the seat. Then I am selecting, choosing, and appointing and coordinating the next senator of South Carolina. If you do it this way, and if it is what it looks like, and if is the biggest two-letter word in the English language, right? Capital I, capital F, if. And there isn't, I can't come up with a reason, I can come up with a speculation, but not a reason to doubt that it's what it looks like. This is the best way to go. And I want you, if you're still struggling with this, I want you to think about something that didn't go this way, that a lot of people were very, very angry about 2 years ago. Joe, the mashed potato brain Biden, went and, you know, debated Donald Trump in the middle of summer, and his own party set him up because they knew they needed to get rid of him. And that way, if he did good, then it would be, they'd be fine. And if it was bad, they had time to replace him, which they did, because we all know what happened, right? To quote Trump, I don't know what he said. You don't know what he said. I don't think he knows what he said either, right? That's how bad it was. So what did the Democratic Party do? Did they run even a pretend nomination process? No, they just anointed Kamala. And we all said, why? That's not how that should work. You shouldn't just choose the person. You should let voters decide. And here's the thing. You guys are probably lucky they didn't, because they would have had a much better candidate. Because she would not have gotten it that way. Word salad cackles would not have gotten the nomination. And those of you that like the fact that Trump's president, or at least are like, I'm glad it's him and not her, if you wouldn't have liked the other candidate, which because you're probably looking at like, oh, I'm going to tell you, I know everybody thinks this was never going to happen, but Josh Shapiro. Josh Shapiro is probably the best candidate they had. He's Jewish, yeah, I know, and he still probably would have just kicked ass. That's what probably would have happened. But you wanted them to at least run the semblance of an electoral process, right? That's what this is. Now, do I think that's all by design and whatever? Not really, no. I don't trust any of these people. However, I do think that's the net result. You take a person who's just going to basically do what she's told. Lindsay would have voted this way. Oh, yeah, that tracks. Okay, click. That's it. She's not going to be a statesman. She's not going to go to Europe. And, hey, at least for 7 months, we don't have somebody trying to start another war over in Europe, because that's what Lindsay's always doing. Lindsay's looking for a war. Fortunately, he's not around to do that anymore. And she's just going to, like, vote up and down. That's all she's going to do. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. So, Jack, if on the 22nd of July she announces that she's running for the seat, what will you say then? I'll say you're right. And I will say I said if. That's what I'll say. And I'll completely agree with you. And I just don't think it'll happen. And I'll tell you another thing. The reason she's also kind of perfect to do with this, if she decides she wants to go for it, I don't think she's a prayer in hell. And I don't mean in the general. I mean in the primary. These people, these other candidates, they have political machines behind them. This isn't a general election where the non-incumbent party's weak and it's like one election after daddy died and you go to the daughter and you just make her a queen. Like, this is not that. The other thing is, what people have said to me is, well, wait till she gets a taste of what it's like to be a senator. For what, 2 weeks? You see what I'm saying? Like, this is not, like, if she's going to be in office for 6 months before she had to do that and make a decision, I'd say, yeah. Yeah, because once you get a taste of that, I agree. I just don't think this happens I don't think it can be put together this quickly. And which would also make it the perfect choice, because even if you thought you were appointing somebody like that, yeah, if they had time to get lured in, they might renege on, even if you had an agreement with them. Hey, this is hey, you know what? I don't think I have to do this. Now, why would McMaster do this? There's two reasons, and they're both good reasons for him, not for you and not for me, that we ended up with a better situation than we could have otherwise. One is that he actually does intend to run for the seat himself. So you would then select a really weak candidate. See? Actually, there's three reasons. Two, because Trump said so, and it's pretty low risk. If everything's going to work out the way it looks like it's going to, and you do what Trump says when you're a member of the Republican Party, because Trump is the Republican Party. And any president in an office can be a problem for you or a helper if you're a governor, but in the same party in the current state, that's even more the case. So number one would be to protect himself if he wants to run. Number two would be to please Trump, right, without taking a big risk on his end when he does so, because you're taking a risk by not pleasing him. You're taking no risk here if it's going to go down the way that it's going to go down. If you want to run, you win. If you don't want to run, you win. So it's the third reason. Because political allies in South Carolina, Norman, Lynch, Mace, Everett, Fry. See, governors need political alliances too, especially to plan for their future if they do want to go for higher office. So this was the best play for him. And it somehow accidentally resulted in basically, again, if it's the way it looks, the most ethical thing you could do. Let's look at it completely different, maybe if you're not attached to it. Let's say that my brother was a senator in the state of Texas and he died. And the exact same situation was going on and they came to me, a podcaster that doesn't want to be in office. And you know I don't want to be in office. So they said, Jack, will you take your brother's seat? I'd be like, that political bastard, I don't really like him. Yeah, but will you just take his seat and vote through the end of the year and let us run a special election in a primary? I would, just for the inside information, I probably would do that. Yeah, I'm just saying. And I would have no, and would you have a problem with that? Well, we know you, we trust you. Yeah, but I still don't, I can't control anything as a single senator. She's not being made president or the freaking king or queen of England or some shit. 1% of a vote on the Senate floor, and the expectation is, what would Lindsey Graham do? Right? What would Lindsey do? Do that. Symbolic. I don't have a problem with it, and I will tell you if I still don't have a problem with it in a couple weeks. And we will see how Spiro Domus' predictions go. Again, I'm saying Norman, Lynch, Everett, your most likely winners. McMaster, Fry, Mace are also probably likely to at least consider this. I don't think McMaster is going to run. I think he's pretty happy being governor right now, but we'll see. But again, if you made me pick Norman, Ralph Norman is probably the next senator from the state of South Carolina. And if it's not Norman, it's probably, Pamela Evett. We'll see. But do you get how to think through something? And do you get the importance in this before reacting emotionally to it? Because I'll be honest, I did too. So what I think I made a post that says something like, what is this obsession with handing Senate seats to women with the same last name as the guy that died? Because it seems like we do this a lot. But the next thing I did after I said that was go, okay, but what is the situation? Who is this person? I've never heard of her. Turns out no one else ever has either. Does she have any political clout? No. Has she ever shown any political ambition? No. What are the odds she's going to run? Polymarket says, if you're right about it, we'll give you a hell of a lot of money for a very small bet. I'll put it that way. Right? So, don't think she wants to win. Don't think she can win. Don't think she wants to run. If that's the case, then this is a whole lot of nothing. And it won't matter anyway in the end, because I don't really care if I'm right here, because I don't think it matters who ends up with that seat. With that, though, let's wrap things up. I want to remind you guys you can help support this show by doing your online shopping where? tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And no matter what you buy, you support us. If you just start your shopping there, it only takes you a couple extra seconds to do that. It barely takes any extra time at all. You can also find all my product reviews. If you're looking for something, I have all the categories alphabetized. You can go through and find the items within the categories that I've recommended. And if I have it there and I have a review on it, I own it, I use it, I bought it, I would buy it again, or I wouldn't recommend it to you. I've run it that way for about 10 years now. Also, please consider picking up a copy of my book. If you like the kind of breakdown we just did with Darlene Graham, instead of being emotional, thinking with a critical systems thinking mindset, looking at second, third, and fourth order consequences, you're going to love this book. It's a lot more interesting way to look at it than a political clown show. With that, I'll catch you guys on Tuesday with another episode. Remember, we do have the ChatGPT for Solopreneurs course reopening in 39 days. That's going to be on August 25th, 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time. And you can sign up to get notified about it and get a shot at a seat in it. JacksLaws.com/countdown. Last four rounds sold out. No reason to believe this one won't as well.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. Better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.